Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is KOWS-LP, Cal's Radio. Broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. Bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cal's Community Radio thanks Many Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Many Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Many Rivers carries fine loose leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Many Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street, Suite 101 in Sebastopol. You can call them at area code 707-829-8871. Email them at info@manyriversbooks.com or visit them on the web at www.manyriversbooks.com. Cal's Community Radio is happy to thank Barbara Ellis of Remax Pros for joining us as a supporter. Barbara Ellis is an experienced realtor who works locally with Remax Realty. She is very familiar with properties in the local areas of Occidental, Sebastopol, Bodega, Freestone, Bodega Bay, and Forestville. Ms. Ellis represents both buyers and sellers and specializes in West County rural properties. Barbara can be reached by phone at area code 707-486-3119 or online at www.barbaraellis.com. Sonoma County Save Our Libraries was formed in 2011 to stop and roll back further library closures and to make the library boards, budgets, and management open and accountable. Improvements have already happened. If you treasure your libraries, then get involved now. For more information, go to www.socosol.org. Cal's Community Radio is membership supported, so if you'd like to keep originally sourced West County radio on the air and be part of the herd, you can join us today by going to www.kows.fm to find out about many membership options. At a field member level for $25 a year, we'll send you a thank you in the form of a Cal's bumper sticker. And as a hay bale member at $40 a year, you'll get a bumper sticker in either a Cal's black and white poster or a moor. And as a Cal's barnyard member for $60 a year, you'll get a hat, mug, or t-shirt featuring the Cal's logo designed by Stanley Mouse. It's more than just the premiums, though. It's really looking for your support to be part of a community, because this is community-based radio. All the programmers you hear on this station are volunteers and work tirelessly to keep this station on the air, but there are very real costs associated with running a community radio station. So we ask you for your support. Go to our website, www.kows.fm, find out how you can join, and click support. Today, our guest by telephone is Lama Tsoltrim Alione, international Tibetan Buddhist teacher and author of Women of Wisdom and Feeding Your Demons. She is the founder and spiritual director of Tara Mandala. In 2009, Lama Tsoltrim received the International Outstanding Woman in Buddhism Award, given in Bangkok, Thailand. We'll get started after a short musical break. This is the Largo from Concerto RV 540 by Antonio Vivaldi from the CD Vivaldi Musica per Mandolino e Liuto, performed by Rolf Lislevand and friends. We'll be right back. Thank you. This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick, The Mystical Positivist. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Robert Schmidt. Rob Schmidt is director of Tayu Meditation Center and co-founder with Jim Wilson and myself of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol, California. This week, our guest by phone is Lama Tsultrim Alione, international Tibetan Buddhist teacher and author of Women of Wisdom and Feeding Your Demons. She is the founder and spiritual director of Tara Mandala. In 2009, Lama Tsultrim received the International Outstanding Award, or Outstanding Woman in Buddhism Award, given in Bangkok, Thailand. Born Joan Rusmanier Ewing in 1947 to a family of considerable accomplishment in New England, the young woman who would become Lama Tsultrim Alione began a lifelong study of Tibetan Buddhism at the age of 19 after encountering it during a long trip to India and Nepal. Among other teachers, she studied with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and at the age of 22 was ordained a nun by His Holiness the 16th Karmapa, who became her root guru. After several years of study and training in both Asia and America, with many wonderful teachers, she made the difficult decision to return her monastic vows, married, and moved with her husband to Puget Sound. There she gave birth to two daughters, and both she and her husband continued their Buddhist studies. The family moved to Colorado to work with Chogyam Trungpa, where Tsultrim separated from her first husband and later married Italian filmmaker Costanzo Alione. They had two children, one of whom died of sudden infant death syndrome. Her Buddhist studies, which helped her come to terms with this death, were the foundation of her first book, Women of Wisdom. She met her third husband, David Pettit, in 1988. This marriage was a true partnership, and the couple collaborated in the creation of Tara Mandala near Pagosa Springs, Colorado, in the early 1990s. For many years, Lama Tsultrim has focused her teachings on the lineage of Machig Lubdrun, the 11th century Tibetan yogini who founded the Chö lineage. In 2007 and 2008, she was recognized and acknowledged as an emanation of Machig Lubdrun by the resident Lama and lineage holder at the monastery in Tibet where Machig lived for most of her long life. In 2008, Lama Tsultrim published the national bestseller, Feeding Your Demons, Ancient Wisdom for Resolving Inner Conflict. Lama Tsultrim Alione, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Thank you.
Well, it's our custom to begin interviews by asking our guests to describe early religious or spiritual impressions and background. In your in a number of places that I've seen that have biographical information about you, including the Taramandala website. You mentioned receiving the gift of a book about Buddhism from your grandmother at the age of 15. So maybe you could start off by telling us what that meant to you, but also about any other early experiences and impressions about religion and or spiritual practice that you would have had before you came to practice Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up in New England, born in Maine, and then from 8 years on, grew up in New Hampshire. And so my early spiritual experiences were really connected to nature and wildness. Hmm. And I didn't have sort of what I would consider to be spiritual experiences as a child. I grew up as a Unitarian. And then it was after the gift of that book, and sort of as a in the process of adolescence, that I began to wake up. And so after the gift of that book, which was Zen Telegrams by Paul Reps, which is painting calligraphies and haikus, I began to have experiences that I would call spiritual. For example, one night in the summer after I had been reading that book, I crawled out onto the roof of our summer house that looked out over a lake. And I just sat there. Of course, I didn't know how to meditate, but I just got really quiet. And I realized I could hear the sound of the pine needles falling on the roof, which, of course, you can't hear unless you're really quiet because it's a very delicate sound. And there was something about that sound and that quietness that triggered an awareness of awareness. So I became conscious of being conscious, or aware of being aware. And I remember it very clearly. I remember that experience, and it was like almost like a door opened, it was like the universe became accessible and vast, and it was like going through a doorway and suddenly going into a huge place that you didn't know existed. And so that was a seed experience. And then in high school I studied Yeats, William Yeats, mm-hmm. the poet, the Irish poet, and he's a mystical poet. And so I was really drawn to anything mystic. And, of course, there really wasn't that much available. It was Yeats and Blake and some of the poets, and Teilhard de Chardin is a mm-hmm. mystical writer. And then I went to college, and it was 1965. And I spent this summer between high school and college in Africa, traveling with a friend of mine and her family. And her father was a poet, and he was working for a foundation that was giving money to African writers and artists. And so we had this amazing journey where we met all these people, writers and artists. And Africa, especially Nigeria, really was a spiritual experience for me. The connectedness with the sound and the drums and nature. And so I went to college, the University of Colorado, as a freshman, carrying my suitcase on my head.
That was a strong impressions you got in Africa.
And then it was the time of the psychedelic revolution in this country. It was 1965, mm-hmm. and so I walked into that, and really, I met people who had taken LSD, and they would talk to me and say, "Are you sure you've never taken it?" Because they, you know, just I was already kind of different in many ways, and so I was kind of swept up in that, and yeah, so that's kind of that wave carried me into India when I was 19. And that's when I met the Tibetans. So that's kind of the sweep of my early spiritual history.
So thank you. What was it that, was it coincidence that took you to India in one sense?
No, not coincidence. In that freshman year in college, I spotted this other girl who looked a little weird like I did crossing the quadrangle, you know, and University of Colorado at that time was mostly sorority girls and ranchers and, you know, some few minorities from Denver. But this girl just looked different to me. And so I started talking to her, and it was Vicki Hitchcock, who you might know because of her film Blessings, and then her other film that just came out, When the Iron Bird Flies, about Buddhism coming to the West. And so we were freshmen together, and her father was the Consul General of Calcutta for the United States. And so both she and I dropped out of college, and so she invited me to go to India with her, and the idea was that we were going to kind of have some sort of meaningful experience and stop being hippies. And
didn't work, huh?
No, of course, you know, we went to the international capital of hippiedom in the world, which was Kathmandu.
Right.
And so what it turned out to be, though, was for me, it was a really transformative experience because I met the Tibetans, and then hitchhiked across India and went to Dharamsala with a Japanese traveler, and sort of escaped from the embassy and that whole world because it was very strange, you know, live in this embassy where you press the buzzer in the morning and the servant arrives and asks you what you want for breakfast. And then we were working for Mother Teresa in one of her homes for unwed mothers in Calcutta. But we would go there in the embassy car, you know, with the flag waving.
That's a great image.
It is.
Yeah, and it, you know, and then we'd go back to the embassy. It was like we were there, but our feet weren't touching the ground. We weren't in India, at least I didn't feel like I was in India, so I managed to escape and then went to Dharamsala and met the Tibetans, and that was a really profound experience for me, transformative. And that whole summer I was in Kathmandu and first met the Tibetans really in Kathmandu, and then went back to Calcutta for a while, and then hitchhiked over to Dharamsala, which was also an amazing experience to hitchhike across India. And, yeah, and then that was when I really began to study a little bit and practice a little bit.
What was it about the Tibetans? Thank you. What was it about the Tibetans that made such a profound impression?
Well, one of the things was that I knew what had happened to them, and they would tell me what had happened to them, you know, in whatever way they could communicate at that time. And many of them had lost their entire family.
Right.
And even seen their whole family killed in front of them. And yet they had this amazing joy and lack of bitterness and lack of anger and vengefulness against the Chinese. And it was so remarkable to... Well, first of all, they were happier than anybody I'd ever met. And then how could they be that happy and have gone through the worst thing that anybody I had ever met had gone through. And so that was really, it really was interesting. You know, it was, how could this be? And what is this about these people that makes them able to be this way? And so that was part of it. And of course, it's their practice, their Buddhist practice that made them able to do that, and their devotion. But it was also for me karmic, because I had such a feeling of arriving home when I met them.
It
wasn't like I hadn't been home before, but I didn't realize what I had been missing until I met it.
Got it.
And so meeting them and just being around as long as the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan people, who were then very Tibetan, you know, that now Dharamsala you see, you know, people who are really westernized or, you know, have really been born in India and grown up there and so on. But then they were Tibetans, and I had such a visceral reaction to being with them and such a longing to stay with them. And it's really hard to explain. It was a feeling. And so there was really no logic, like why, except that what I told you before about how could they be how they were and have gone through what they had gone through. But it was a karmic thing, from a karmic connection from past lives that I was experiencing.
Got it. So then you started practicing various Tibetan practices, as I understand it. How was that for you? What was your experience of that, and did that draw you further towards the path that you later followed?
Well, what happened was I met the Tibetans, and I didn't really start learning to meditate because there was no one really to teach at that time. And then I went back, hitchhiked back across India and went back to Kathmandu and reconnected with this monk in Swambu Monastery who became a very close friend of mine. And then my parents called me back to the West. And so I was back there for about a year, and then went to Sami Ling in Scotland, just as it was beginning. And Drumba Rinpoche had just come out of the hospital from his accident where he ran into the joke shop. I don't know if you know that story, do you?
No. I know he'd had an accident. I don't know about a joke shop.
That's kind of interesting. He was a monk, or
yes,
supposed to be a monk, but he really hadn't been a monk for a long time, and he was drinking and having girlfriends and so on. And so one night he was quite drunk, and he was driving back to the monastery, and there was a moment when he had to decide whether to go to the monastery or to go toward his girlfriend's house. And instead he just went straight and hit the joke shop.
That's hilarious. I didn't know that story.
Yeah.
That's great.
And it was, it was quite a bad accident, actually. And so I was in the hospital for quite a while, and then came out, and he decided to disrobe and took the path that he took.
Right.
But anyway, I met him. I arrived there the day he came out of the hospital, and I met him. And so that summer, that was the summer of 1969, I began to meditate. But still, I didn't have a teacher because there were no teachers, really, at Sami Ling. We were meditating 5 hours a day, and there was a schedule. But there was no instruction. And so we come out of meditation, and you know, one person would turn to the other and say, "Did you get a buzz?" And that was it. You know, we really had no idea what we were doing. And then I left there eventually and went back to India. and arrived in India right at the around Christmas 1969, and then went to Kathmandu again. And Karmapa had just arrived in Kathmandu for the first time in 13 years. And so I eventually was ordained by him in Bodh Gaya in January of 1970 on the full moon. I went to him. What happened was he was there, and everyone was talking about him and so on. And but Vicky had said, you know, Karmapa, I met him in Sikkim, and he's really fat, and he wears a big gold watch, and, you know, I don't think he's really spiritual. and so I didn't really want to meet him, because I had the idea that my guru would be thin and sort of austere-looking, like Kali Rinpoche, or like the statues of the Buddha, and that wasn't how Karmapa looked. And then I had some friends that said, let's just go meet him, let's just go. And so they talked me into it, so we went up to Swayambhu, which is a sacred mountain in the Kathmandu Valley, and he was giving empowerments up there, and he was doing the black hat ceremony, which is his personal ceremony that he's most famous for. And I stood there and was just completely transfixed and felt his blessing so tangibly. It was really something I couldn't ignore. And then afterwards, when I went up, you know, everybody files by and you get blessed by an object. He has sort of a stick with like a cylinder on the end, and he puts it on everybody's head, and so I went by and I looked up at him, and he smiled. It's just this amazing smile, and it was like the whole world became luminous in that moment. And then afterwards, I felt different. It was just a very tangible thing, and I really, as you know, as I said, I was sort of had a negative attitude toward him. And then I started to have this feeling that there was something I was supposed to do. And I guess I couldn't sleep. There was something I was supposed to do, and I felt very agitated. And I knew I needed to find a teacher. But I was determined it wasn't him, still. And there was a really wonderful-looking yogi who was more like what I thought my teacher should look like. And so I went to him and said, you know, will you be my teacher? And he took this picture of His Holiness Karmapa down off his shrine, and he said, this is your teacher. I was like, no, you. And he said, no, him. And so he wouldn't accept me, and he kept directing me toward His Holiness. And then one day I had been reading the sadhana of all the siddhas that Trungpa Rinpoche had written in Taksang in Bhutan. And I'd been reading that since I'd been in Samyang all the whole trip overland. I drove overland from London to Kathmandu through Iran and Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan, all the countries. Reading the sadhana, and there's a line in it that says, the only offering I can make is to follow your example. And in that sadhana, there's a lot about His Holiness Karmapa. And so one night, it was a light bulb lit up, and I thought, he's a monk. I should follow his example and become a nun. And that was what it was what all that agitation was about. I needed to get that message. And once I got it, I went to him, and then he looked at me for a long time. It was as though he saw everything, you know, the past, present, and the future. And he said, yes, I'll ordain you, but not here. I want to ordain you in Bodh Gaya. And so he said, get robes and meet me there. And so I went to Kathmandu, and I bought these Tibetan robes. You know, the Tibetans would come down out of the Himalayas and sell their robes because they're so heavy and so hot. Mm. So I bought these big wool robes and went to Bodh Gaya, and then was ordained there by him on the full moon of January 1970. And I still didn't really even know what Buddhism was exactly. It was really very... It was happening at a real feeling level, mm-hmm. more than an intellectual level. And then at the time of my ordination, on the day as I came out of the ordination, the translator, who was a Bhutanese doctor, said to me, you know, His Holiness made a prophecy about you when he saw you that first day in Swambu, when you first came to the first empowerment, and he said that you would benefit beings in this life and that you were connected to him in past lives. And so he had known all along what would happen and who I was, and I think he was the one that was causing all that agitation in Kathmandu, trying to get the message through to me.
Got it.
It was quite thick. And so...
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening?
There I was.
Yeah.
As a nun, but I didn't even know what Buddhism was. I mean, I didn't know what the Four Noble Truths were.
You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick, and co-host, Rob Schmidt. And we're speaking by phone with Lama Tsultri Marayone, founder of the international Buddhist community Tara Mandala, and author of Women of Wisdom and Feeding Your Demons.
Well, that's a wonderful story, and I have to say that the idea of becoming a Tibetan Buddhist nun without even knowing the Four Noble Truths, it's fantastic and amazing, and reality is always more interesting than fiction. So you're a nun, and you begin presumably studying at that point in a more mm-hmm. more formal way. And that study went on for many years, I understand.
Yeah, so I think that the way it happened to me was really because of the era, that moment in history, mm-hmm. that there weren't translators, really. There weren't Westerners who had become translators yet, mm-hmm. or that was just beginning to happen. And so what happened then was I moved to Swambu, to that mountain where I had had that first empowerment with His Holiness, and where it was actually the first place I'd gone when I went to Kathmandu first in 1967. And so I began to learn Tibetan, and I began to get teachings from Sapchu Rinpoche, who's the Lama there, and receive empowerments and practice, do meditation. And so that was really the beginning of my training. And so I trained with him for a year, and then my visa ran out and I couldn't get it renewed, and so I had to leave Nepal and went to India, and then I went to Darjeeling to Kalu Rinpoche, who was a really amazing yogi and had done many, many years of retreat. And so then I studied with him and began to understand the preliminaries of the Nundro practice, the foundational practices. And mm-hmm. we would go every day for 6 weeks for a couple of hours every afternoon, and he would teach about the precious human body and karma, impermanence, the nature of samsara, and so on. And of course, at the time, we didn't realize how lucky we were. There were about five of us sitting in this room with Kala Rinpoche for a couple of hours every day, and just it was like a shower of blessings, really.
Yeah.
And there was an American there who had learn Tibetan to the point where he could translate, and so he translated for us. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Bodh Gaya. Well, actually, first I went back to Sikkim and met His Holiness Karmapa again. And he said he had been watching me, and he wanted me to become a fully ordained nun, the Gelungma transmission, which you would have to go to Taiwan to receive. He wanted to reestablish that, and he wanted me to do that. And so I spent a week there with him, and I had a very powerful relationship with him, very, very deep. I still do. And he taught me a lot in my dreams. And he gave me initiations in my dreams. And they were very specific. I knew the whole teaching when I would wake up, I could write it down. And it would be very specific teachings. Like I remember one was the 13 levels of the Bodhisattva path. And I could write them down in the morning. And so even though I wasn't with him physically, he was working with me at night. And so my path was very much this connection with him, Guru Yoga. And so I went to Bodh Gaya and did a retreat there, and then Sarnath, where the Buddha gave his first teachings, and studied with another Lama there, and then eventually went to Manali, which is in Himachal Pradesh, which is where Dharamsala is in northwest India. And that's when I did my first longish retreat, which was 6 months. And I lived in a little hut and did the preliminary practices called the Nundro, the first of which is 100,000 prostrations, full-length prostrations, which is very physical and very difficult, and it's probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life was to do those 100,000 prostrations.
I've heard similar comments from others as well. I've heard similar comments about the difficulty as well.
Yeah, it's kind of the lion at the gate, you know, if you get through that, then you've shown that you've got some stamina.
Got it.
Yeah, so I stayed there in India for several years, and then I was really missing my family after a while. I hadn't seen them for maybe 3 years at that point. Mm-hmm. And I had a divination done by Abu Rinpoche, who was my meditation master there in Manali. And so I was waiting, you know, what's he going to say? You know, so the question was, should I go or shouldn't I go? And I remember I was sitting in my room, and every afternoon he would come down and he would circumambulate for exercise the house for maybe 20 minutes. And so he walked by my window, and so I said, Rinpoche, did you do the Mo? And the Mo is the divination. And he said, oh, I forgot. And I had been like sitting on pins and needles for days, you know, like waiting for this. So then he said, I'll do it tonight. And or I'll do it in the morning. And so the next day he did it, and I thought, oh, Rinpoche, what did it say? What should I do? And he said, it's the same. It's the same if you go or stay. So I decided since it was the same, I would go. And then returned to America. And so I was the only nun in America. The only Buddhist nun, Tibetan or Western.
Yeah. That's fascinating. What was that like?
Difficult. It was weird. I mean, I remember, so I went to Trungpa Rinpoche, then established Tail of the Tiger in Vermont, which was now is called Karma Choling. Mm-hmm. And I went there, I re-met him. And then he told me to go into retreat for 3 months until he got back, which I did. And then I came out, and, you know, his situation was really wild parties, a lot of drinking, and it was not monastic in any way. And there was nobody else you know, trying to do what I was doing. And then I went into, I had to get my head shaved, and I didn't know how to do that. And so I decided to go to a barber shop in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. So I walk in, you know, wearing my robes, and the whole place becomes silent. You know, there's probably like 10 men in there, you know, getting their hair cut or cutting their hair. And
right.
And so I said, I need to have my head shaved. And they were like, oh, yeah, okay. And so the whole time I was in there, I mean, it must have been half an hour, nobody said a word.
Oh, my God.
I think they were all just completely in shock. And so I shaved my head. And I don't think he'd ever actually shaved anybody's head either, because it came out looking sort of like a badly cut lawn. And then I walked out, and I'm sure the minute I walked out, they were like, you know, couldn't stop talking about who that was and what had happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it just, that gives you a sense of how difficult it was, just because it was such an odd thing to be.
Yeah.
And then people would ask me if I had a brain tumor because I had a shaved head, or if I was Hare Krishna.
There you go.
Because that had started by then. And then the whole situation of trying to be around Trungpa Rinpoche was very difficult. And I was very interested in his teachings and what he was teaching and so on, but I felt very kind of isolated as a nun.
Yeah.
And so after about a year, I went back to India, and he had asked me to invite His Holiness Karmapa to America for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a letter for him and some gifts that Trungpa Rinpoche had sent and so on. And then when I got there was a war in Sikkim. It was when India was taking over Sikkim,
mm-hmm.
because it used to be like Bhutan and an independent country, and so I couldn't go there, couldn't see Karmapa, and I was really feeling like I should probably disrobe,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted to see him first, and because he had these aspirations for me to become fully ordained, but that wasn't to be. I couldn't go, and eventually decided to give back my vows to Khamtra Rinpoche and Tashi Jung, and so I gave back my vows and the spring of 1973, and then.
Well, I wanted to ask you something about that. That I don't think Westerners who aren't familiar with Buddhism may understand that returning vows from a monastic is not out of the ordinary or unprecedented. Right? There's a formal procedure for that. It's not like a Catholic priest who somehow fails at his commitments, or people historically have done this, right?
Yeah, it's not quite like Thailand, where people take vows temporarily, and so there's really no stigma at all attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
The Tibetans usually, once they take the vows, that's it for life.
Mm-hmm.
But the Tibetans are very flexible, you know, in general, and so what happened when I gave back my vows was I was told by Khamtra Rinpoche to dedicate all the merit, which is the positive karma that you accumulate as a monastic, to dedicate that to all beings, and then to do 100,000 syllable mantras of Vajrasattva, which is a purification practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that would be it. That would be enough. And basically he said to hold the vows even for one day is a great blessing in this degenerate time. And so I didn't end up with a feeling of guilt or failure, but I did have a hard time still in the transition. I'm not sure exactly why, but I think I had expected that I would stay a nun my whole life, and when it became apparent that really wasn't going to work for me, I had a lot of dreams about, like, about the robes and, either I had the robes on and I needed to take them off, or I didn't know what to wear because I should be wearing the robes. And, you know, that kind of inner conflict was really held in my dreams. Or I would go back to Swayambhu, and my friend Gyawa, who was a monk, would say, "What happened? Where are you? You know, where are your robes?" And so there was a process that I went through. And then I got pregnant really quite quickly after. And so suddenly I was not only not a nun, but I was pregnant. And so it was really, you know, from nun to mother very quickly. And so that, you know, is for your body and psychologically and emotionally, being pregnant is very intense. And mm-hmm. And it wasn't a planned thing, obviously. And so it was a lot of transition, and within a year, I had had a baby, and that was challenging too.
So, at that time, were you still studying Buddhism or
meditating? Yeah, my husband he was never ordained, but he had lived as a monk for about the same amount of time, and I had actually met him in Holland before I went to Sami Lang. So we had been corresponding for about 4 years, and then we got together after I gave back my vows, and so then we came back to America, and we really lived a practiced life. We practiced, and we walked, and we lived on very little money in a berry picker shack in the Puget Sound on Vashon Island, and we just practiced all day, and then we had Sharon, my oldest daughter, who's now, well, she's 39 now, actually. She just had a birthday. And just had her own child this past year. And so I have never stopped. I continued to study. There was a lama in Seattle that we would go in to study with, a really great scholar and meditator named Dejan Rinpoche. And then we moved to Boulder, and I continued to study with Trungpa Rinpoche, and he asked me to start teaching at that point. And so I taught meditation, and I also was teaching at Naropa University.
Right.
And
so I wanted to ask, in feeding your demons during this transition, particularly when you first returned your vows and became a mother, you mentioned that although you'd been introduced to the Chö practice, that you were starting to sort of, it started to become more of a presence for you at this time. Is that fair?
Yes.
And I'm just interested in how that practice began to be relevant for you as going through these transitions.
You know, the Chö, it's interesting because it was always this thread for me, and you know, at first I didn't even know what it was, but I saw some Chö drums and in Amsterdam before I went to Sami Lang, before I met Trungpa Rinpoche. There was a Chö drum in a store in Amsterdam where they would sell, you know, things from Asia, and I would actually go to visit this drum every day because I was so drawn to it, and I couldn't afford to buy it. I never did buy it, but when I disrobed is when I met the Chö. And so
perhaps you could describe that for our listeners just really briefly.
What it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the Chö practice, Chö means to sever or to cut, and it's essentially a practice of offering the body in order to cut through ego clinging. So what you're cutting or severing is ego clinging. And it has roots in shamanism in Tibet and also in Buddhism. So it's really a practice in which you undergo your own death and you offer your body and you feed various different guests, of course, symbolically. And so you feed Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and then eventually you feed your demons, whether it's illnesses or your fears or various ways that you cling. That's what your demons are. It's sort of what takes your energy, what eats your energy, and so in meeting that practice, first in Manali, when right around when I got pregnant, I heard it for the first time, and I didn't really know what it was, but it was one of those just karmic recognitions that I've had throughout my life, that I knew that I knew it, but I didn't know what it was. And so essentially what the true practice does is, through that offering of the body, which is what we cling to most dearly, if you think about it, you know, you'd hold on to your body more than you'd hold on to your house or your car or your money.
Right.
The body is sort of the most fundamental thing that we cling to. And so reversing that pattern is reversing ego clinging. And so in the practice, you actually leave your body, your consciousness leaves your body, and you become a wrathful Dakini, which is a female wisdom goddess. And then she cuts up the body and places it into the skull cup, which expands. So it's like the top of your head becomes a container, and then the rest of your body is put into that. And then it becomes a nectar through a sort of alchemical fire that purifies it. And then all these various guests are fed from that. And so that's the traditional practice of Chut. And so I met that at the time when I was in that transition, and then did it throughout my pregnancy. But it really wasn't until much later that I began to understand it, and where it really became meaningful for me.
Well, it's interesting, in the book Feeding Your Demons, you're very clear that the core paradox of this practice is something, at least to a Western mentality, is that rather than fighting against the things that are issues or problems in our lives, you're actually trying to move towards these things. Or,
yes,
as you put it, you feed it. You're completely embracing and connecting with the things that we most resist.
Yeah, well, that's you put it very well.
So as a mother, you were even though at first you didn't grasp it in the way that you later came to do, you were still getting something from it.
Yes,
the practice, I guess.
Yes, it was again that felt sense, and of course I knew what I was saying, but it really wasn't until probably about 6 years later that I began to understand the meaning of it. And that was when I was living in Italy, and began to understand that these things that we call demons in Buddhism, or the Maras, are not something. I mean, they can be sort of like Buddhist concepts, like ego clinging, but that the demons, the personal demons, were really the issues of my life. They were my demons, and we all have them. And every person's demons are different, but we all have them. And so once I realized that that my demons were something that I could work with through the Chod practice, and that the way to work with them was not to fight them, but to move toward them, to listen to them, and to nurture them. It's a complete paradigm shift from what we normally do. In almost any religion, we try to protect ourselves. We pray, we promise, we invoke, and so on, to protect ourselves. And in the Chod practice, we do the opposite, where we invite that which we are resisting or that which we are afraid of we invite that to dinner, quite literally. Mm-hmm. And the dinner is our own body.
And it's interesting that even some of the Eastern practices have the notion of slaying the ego. And this is not really slaying the ego either.
No, it's the opposite.
Nursing the ego. And it's...
Yeah, that's what to me is so interesting about it, and why I think it also is somewhat of a feminine paradigm, mm-hmm. because it's inclusive and it's not power over. It's including the shadow elements in the psyche through inviting them to become present and then feeding them. And so usually we're in a state of tension with our demons, whether it's an addiction or a fear or an illness. We're fighting against it. We use that language every day. You know, you hear it every day on the radio. Somebody died after a long battle with cancer, for example.
Right.
And so with feeding, not fighting, that cancer would be personified, and then it would be invited to speak, and then to find out what the real need is that's under the cancer, and then to feed it to complete satisfaction, whatever it needs. And so essentially what happens then is there's an integration in the psyche. And so these parts of ourselves that normally we try to shun, repress, or somehow get rid of, become integrated. And the energy that's tied up in those demons then becomes accessible and becomes the ally. And so the very same energy that's tied up in the demon, I mean, if you think about something like an addiction,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if either of you have addictions or, you know, but I'm sure people who are listening do, you know, even if it's not a very strong addiction, we do have things that we grasp after. And so think of the amount of energy that you spend either trying to get that substance or battle against it. And if all that energy through being listened to and being fed and nurtured, cared for, then if all that energy that's tied up in that addiction becomes accessible, it's a huge amount of energy that has been draining out of your being. And so that's the principle behind feeding your demons. And it's so interesting to me that as I was writing the book Feeding Your Demons, it was a time of really tremendous polarization in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Bush era, and
right.
There was this, I mean, it's still present, but it was really extreme at that time, of just everything being polarized. And so that what this principle of the true practice was offering was really a very powerful alternative of feeding, not fighting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think we're at a point where we're going to take a short break, but when we return from the break, we'd really like to go into a little more detail about the foundation of this practice, because it is a fascinating shift you describe, this whole model of going towards something rather than resisting or avoiding. And I see elements of it in other traditions, but nothing quite as embodied and visualized in the way that you describe in your book.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
So we will be back shortly. The time is 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is KOWS LP, Cows Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial, and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is Stuart Gudnick. In the second hour of our program, co-host Rob Schmidt and I will continue our conversation with Lama Soltri Marione, founder of the International Buddhist Community Tara Mandala and author of Women of Wisdom and Feeding Your Demons. Chaos Community Radio wishes to thank the Occidental Community Council for their generous support. The Occidental Community Council strives to meet the unmet needs of the Occidental area. The council invites you to attend its meetings every third Saturday of the month at 10:30 a.m. at the YMCA Community Center. Chaos Community Radio also wishes to thank Advanced Security for their support. Advanced Security is a family-owned firm providing security and fire alarm systems. Please say you were referred by Chaos Radio. For more information, see them online at advancedsecurity.us or call them at area code 707-544-9200. The Ceres Community Project works to restore locally grown organic whole food to its place as the foundation of health for people, communities, and the planet. Their integrated approach brings teens to the kitchen to learn about growing, preparing, and eating healthy foods through serving as the program's chefs. Each year, they prepare thousands of beautiful, delicious, organic meals for individuals and families facing cancer and other life-threatening illnesses. For more information, see them at www.ceresproject.org, that's C-E-R-E-S, or call them at 707-829-5833. Chaos Community Radio is membership supported. We encourage you to go to www.kows.fm to find out about different membership levels. I just want to remind you that Chaos is membership supported, but all of our programmers are volunteers. So we support the station with our work. We look and hope that we can get our listeners to support with their generosity and help keep the operating expenses for the station sort of at bay. But this is a great community. Our listeners are definitely part of it, and we appreciate your support. We'll return to the show after a short musical break. This is the Largo from Trio RV82 by Antonio Vivaldi from the CD Vivaldi Musica per Mandolino e Liuto, performed by Rolf Lislevent and Friends. We'll be right back.